This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
This is Created Equal from 101.9 WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm here with the show's producer, Kerry Jr. II.
Hello.
To talk about this week's shows.
Yeah.
And some things we want to highlight in this week of shows. The first week of shows on Created Equal.
And, you know, I don't know if this was intentional, but we have a solid through line where we talked about reparations. Kind of generally talked about the backlash or the concern or anxiety around reparations for white people.
Yeah. It was a wonderfully kind of themed week. And what we're doing today is taking a look back at parts of those conversations that we think really make the points that that those conversations were supposed to.
On the first episode, we had Jamon Jordan and Desiree Cooper, two Detroiters who can really ground the episode in Detroit.
But also explain the connection between Detroit and the nation.
Yes.
Jamon Jordan is the official historian for the city of Detroit, the very first official historian in the city's history. Someone who is really focused, though, on the experience of African Americans here in Detroit and how that interrelates to the city's overall history. And then we had Desiree Cooper with us as well. She's an author and a journalist and a poet, someone who lived here for a really long time and whose work really crystallizes some of the challenges of inequality and the promises of opportunity from a national perspective. The two of them were a great mix for that first show in the way that they helped us frame what we hope to do on the program.
Mm-hmm. Nice thread from Detroit to Created Equal.
Absolutely. The city is changing really profoundly, I think. I mean, I was born here in the early 70s and really came to know the city as an African-American city, as a black city, right? And that's the first generation really that understood that. I feel like that is changing really profoundly and that kids growing up here now are having a different experience. That can be frightening, I suppose, and that can be a challenge. But you were talking about how it was perhaps an opportunity. Talk about a little more of how we make sure that people don't get left out, left behind while the city goes through this transformation.
Yeah, I mean, that is the question, right? You know, there's this feeling that that a certain generation held it together with bubble gum and string, and now that Detroit is enjoying a little bit more popularity, people want to sort of just come in and snatch it from under them. One thing I always heard in Detroit for a million years was like, downtown, why are you focusing on downtown when the neighborhoods are suffering?
Mm-hmm.
And that became sort of an us-them conversation. Well, guess what? Downtown is a neighborhood.
It is now, right?
It is now.
In ways it wasn't when I was a kid, right?
Exactly.
I mean, yeah.
And so that's an interesting, now the paradigm has shifted a little bit because I would say that probably you have a certain type of person or people that are living in Detroit, downtown, probably more with means, often without children, either young or older. Mm-hmm. And so that can mean certain things, but it's not necessarily a racial divide.
What do you mean by that? What is the divide if it's not race?
It might be socioeconomic,
yeah.
And I think there is I don't know how many actual families by percent of people living in Detroit. I know there's areas near downtown where there's a lot of neighborhood family kind of life. So it's a certain kind of person. But my point being is, like, can we see Detroit's downtown being a generator for neighborhood development? First of all, it is increasing the tax base. It is attracting other people into the city who had not considered living there before. It is creating a density, which is key to a whole lot of things. But one of the things is crime prevention. That when you have spaces, public spaces that defend themselves, meaning lots of traffic, lots of eyes on this. Let's look at the riverfront. Let's look at Dequindre Cut. Let's look at, you know, parks. When you're doing that kind of developing, the places have a feeling, an air of safety. It's more of an urban, a luxurious urban environment.
Sure.
As opposed to a dangerous urban, whether or not it's true. Okay, the reality versus the experience are two different things. And so how can downtown as a neighborhood start to generate more for those areas that are not downtown? For example, how far out is downtown? What is downtown?
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the questions that we're facing right now, I think, with this project to remake I-375 into a street, right? That really would kind of extend the east side of downtown more into Lafayette Park and the other neighborhoods over there. But you know, I want to go back to this idea of taking what's happening downtown and making it matter to places that aren't downtown. I think that is absolutely the most critical question that we face. And I always say that is the job, the very job of city government, right? To leverage this new interest and enthusiasm and investment in one part of the city so that it benefits people who might not ever go to that part of the city, right? And certainly don't live there. And I don't feel like we've done the best job of that. You know, and it's early. I mean, we're probably a decade and a half now into the real aggressive kind of investments that we've seen.
But aren't you seeing like effects in North End? Aren't you seeing the nearer east side getting some? I mean, it is glacial. I'm going to grant you that.
Yeah. No,
but
is.
I remember a Detroit where downtown was downtown, New Center was New Center. And then, you know, that was kind of it in terms of a critical mass. Midtown was barely anything. Now between downtown, Midtown, and New Center, it's almost contiguous. There's a lot that needs to be done.
North End,
for example.
Right. Go ahead, Jamon.
So one of the things that I believe would change the way we talk about this is if the critical mass of people, like you got a significant number of people who've relocated to the city of Detroit and they're living downtown, midtown, in the near downtown areas, Lafayette Park. So I'm seeing that. What would be a critical mass is if those people are now, we see them involved in things that are not where, just downtown. Mm-hmm. So like Desiree's already said, that many of them are young or they don't have children. When we see those people who are, whether it's they're at a different socioeconomic level, but they're African American, or if they're not even of the same race, they're whites or other non-African Americans, when we see their children at Denby. When we see their children at the neighborhood schools, then we will begin to see, number one, they're being seen not as living in a suburb, because for many people in the city of Detroit, downtown has become almost like a suburb in the city of Detroit.
Right.
And so we don't see them as living like that. They're Detroiters now, number one. And number two, if those things happen, we know, just historically, we know that when the schools are more are less African American dominated in population, that resources with those
follow.
They follow those, so the schools will become less unequal as different groups of people become students at those schools
and invested in, and so all those things
begin to happen. And so right now we have, like, we don't want to see it that way, but it's like downtown is its own thing. Right. And the rest of the city is something else, which you said earlier. That's a challenge that we need to overcome, that downtown shouldn't be separate.
It should be fueling the change in other parts.
Right. Yeah, that's my point. Like, how can it be a generator? And when you get to education, man.
Right.
Yeah. That's the golden goose, right? Yeah. I mean, you've got to have that for any city to survive or thrive, and we have not done nearly enough here to make sure that works. So I want to ask you both also, why does that, what we were just talking about, why does that matter outside of Detroit? What does that tell us about America? That struggle that we're having here, this tension, this opportunity, because of this change. Part of the premise of the show is Detroit is ground zero for all of these conversations, issues. But talk about why that's true, Juman.
Yeah, so it's true because, as you stated, Detroit really gives us the bird's eye view. It allows us to really see through the lens of Detroit. You can see the inequality of America. And so if you're talking about housing discrimination or housing segregation, Detroit is ground zero for that. It is the Sipes versus McGee case, which will be joined with another case to make it to the Supreme Court, Shelley versus Kramer, which will overturn race restrictive covenants as being constitutional to be enforced by the government. It is Detroit that
comes out of here.
It comes out of Detroit. Community. It is Detroit that is going to really push the limits of what school inequality and school integration is going to be with Milliken v. Bradley in 1974. That's when the Supreme Court says, okay, this is the limit. We're not going any further than what we proposed in Brown v. Board. We're not going to be forcing cities to bus students to suburbs, and we're not going to force suburbs to accept these students from the inner city, which, of course, created a Supreme Court-enforced or a Supreme Court-endorsed school inequality. Yeah. Now you can go to a suburb and not ever have to worry about African-Americans being at those schools from the city of Detroit, because if you move away, you can have an all-white school again.
Right.
And it can be unequal, and the resources can be unequal. And so we see this, and Detroit had this major fight over police brutality. Of course, it exploded with the 1967 uprising, but it didn't end there, because stress is created after the 1967 uprising. And so we get Stop the Robbers, Enjoy Safe Streets, which was really nothing but a brutal elite police force, and a lot of these elite police forces around the country are dealing with these repercussions right now. In Memphis, the Scorpion team or Scorpion
just a
unit.
Version of stress. It's
modern version of stress. Yeah. You know, they killed Tyree Nichols, and the video shows that it's just really a brutal killing. Well, Detroit had to deal with that. We were ground zero for police brutality, school inequality, housing discrimination, and job discrimination. So all of those facets of inequality that we think of around the country, Detroit has been a center of the fight against it, and of course the victim of many of these forms of inequality.
Yeah, and Desiree, one of the other things I always think about when I think about Detroit is how opportunity is also finds its parents here in the city of Detroit. So Henry Ford perfects this idea of mass production of a car, which of course is applied to lots of other things, and the work that goes into that creates this idea of a middle class. Mm-hmm. That's all ours. We did that then shared it with everybody else. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about the problems that we've had, they also walk alongside all of these things, that these powerful things that we created and gave to America to create what we have now.
That's right.
Absolutely. And that's writ big and small. I mean, I find that Detroit is a town that is definitely willing to experiment. And they're also often, and I don't mean like the government, I mean the people. or not necessarily the government, because the people have felt like there's, you know, no one's coming to save us. So now what do we do? Okay, well, we're going to police our own block, okay?
Right.
We don't need that. We're going to create our own Angels Night Army, you know? If no one's coming to save us, we're going to do that. So There's such bustling entrepreneurial spirit in Detroit that is literally kitchen table kinds of businesses, and it is such an ethic in Detroit that only now I think is being buoyed by some philanthropic investment. You have, you know, mini grants and things like that from foundations. You have some businesses doing incubators and things like that. Well, we've been, you know, doing that for a long time. And, you know, wow, take all of that spirit and just look at what happened on Livernois. How many of the businesses that went into those stores were actually pop-ups?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Avenue of Fashion.
That's right. There were lots of businesses that got grants, got a little bit of starter capital. They went through Textown, that kind of thing. So I think that where there is nothing, there is room for creativity. For something.
That's right.
We've done that even with education.
We do that over and over here in Detroit.
We do it over and over, but it's a strength. It's something that can be leveraged, but also other places can sort of see that example. So it's it's not just the assembly line.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, it's how neighborhoods look at the urban farming, and it's not the trendy, sexy urban farming necessarily. But people have been turning their entire backyards into gardens for a very long time. We're Southerners.
Our entire side lots, right? Everyone.
Lots. And that whole idea of you may not own it, but you live near it, so you're responsible for it. So take it and cultivate it. Take it, make a playground. I mean, these are things that we've been doing for a long time that then government, be planners, whatever, can look at what's happening and support that so that it can flourish and come up to scale.
Yeah. We'll be right back with more Created Equal.
Speaking of threads and through lines from Detroit Today and Created Equal, another guest this week, Linda Mann and Justin Hansford, both from the African American Redress Network, were both on they have been on Detroit Today, also on Created Equal, talking about reparations.
Yeah. And, you know, they are part of this African American Redress Network, which works with cities all over the country in their efforts to try to figure out what damage was done to African Americans in their community and how to make up for that damage. They work in a really interesting way, though. It's not so much of a consulting role as it is a setting of framework and context for these cities and really helping them pinpoint what in their histories, I think, they should be thinking about and how to connect that to goals and outcomes.
I mean, in the title of the organization alone, Redress Network, not Reparations Network, they've thought of, or at least they've collected and tracked organizations that have tried to find solutions for the historical wrongs that were done that take many different shapes and forms.
I mean, I think in terms of the number of people I talk to about this subject, they have the most kind of global perspective and grounded in what's actually happening. I mean, I feel like they know more about which cities are involved in this effort and what they're doing than most people I talk to. So that was a great conversation as well.
And because of that, they have a really good perspective on how complicated this is, how it's not one size fits all.
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right.
That was a good conversation.
Yeah.
Check it out.
Linda and Justin, I want to start this time with a different idea, and it's taking us into the future, I guess. Let's say we get to the point where a large-scale effort at reparations or redress is undertaken in our country, and we're living in a society where that has been done. I once had a conversation with Ta-Nehisi Coates after his epic piece in The Atlantic about reparations, about this. And I asked him whether he feared, like I do sometimes, that if this happened, we would move to a space where people might believe that there isn't more work to be done, that the obligation to African Americans would be fulfilled, and that there wouldn't be more to have to think about, more to have to do to make up for what is now several centuries of inequality, of discrimination. And so I would love to have both of you talk just a little about what you imagine that world would look like, and whether we would have a real problem, a new problem that would deny the inevitable, I think, lingering effect of systemic inequality, even in a world where reparations or redress was undertaken and in a serious way. Justin, is that a realistic fear?
That is. I'm glad you raised that issue. It's not a valid fear to me. Number one, of course, we live in a world right now where plenty of people are resisting doing any sort of reparative work. So it's not as if once reparations happens, it'll be a new day where suddenly people will stop wanting to help Black people.
They don't want to do it now, right?
You know, but it is a good point that perhaps what you're saying is that then in this imaginary future, even the progressive communities who are willing to help will feel like, okay, we've crossed this hurdle and now we can move on to the next problem. What the issue here is, I believe that what we're ultimately aiming for is a just, equitable society, and the work of creating that justice is never going to stop. Even if it's, you know, even if hypothetically we get to a stage where we say, okay, we have made a major step in redressing past harms, you still have to create equity. You still have to have access to clean water and access to education and access to housing. And these are projects that are going to take generations for us to get to a place where we are on a equal playing field across society. So it's not a project. Even if you have an infusion of funds that happened over the course of 5 or 10 years, you're not going to be able to completely transform American institutions in a decade or so and say, now we can move on. Everything is equitable. That project of creating a fair and just society is a never ending project. Hmm. So to me, I understand where people are, going with that. You know, it is this idea that, you know, we have a claim right now, and if we promote our claim and our claim is redressed, then we won't have any sort of claims anymore. And where will we be then? But it's always going to be up to us to create the best lives for our communities, for our people, for our children, as we possibly can. That's never going to change. That's how it is now. It's how it's going to be in the future. And, you know, it's one of those imaginary fears, you know, that is sort of like this fear of too much progress.
Right.
You could say that for anything you do. You say, why would we end mass incarceration? Because then all these people would have to find jobs or something. No, we want to end mass incarceration now, and then we'll deal with those other problems.
We'll deal with the problems when they come, right?
When they come, right? Yep. Yeah. So,
yeah,
you know, it's a good discussion, but I do want to make sure that, you know, we stay in a place of hope and a place of change, and it's never gonna be a situation where someone's gonna say, okay, well, we don't have to work for justice anymore because we made this one leap forward.
Yeah.
Society's always going to have to work for justice.
Yeah, and I think the difficulty is in making that point, because, you know, even if you support the idea of reparations in this on a large scale, I think there's some education we still need to do about the fact that that won't fix everything. It can't fix everything. I mean, we're talking about centuries and an entire society, an entire nation that was built on these ideas of inequality. And no matter what we do from a reparative standpoint, we can't erase what is already there, and I think it would be crazy to think that that repair could make it possible for us never to have to think or talk about this again, Linda.
Yeah, and I just want to I want to add to this conversation a couple of points. First of all, you know, the United States is not alone in this conversation. There, countries across the world are working to respond to colonialism and the impacts of colonialism, which was centuries. So you're not going to undo centuries of harm in which, you know, nations, you know, dislocated people from land, oppressed people culturally, changed economic structures, even denied the existence of communities, right? And so this is a worldwide conversation as well. And justice in that, you know, and that is the importance also, and I want to raise this up, of Justin's work at the United Nations, because raising this up to the international arena is incredibly important, because the United States is often looked upon as an island unto itself. Like, we don't have these issues. Mm-hmm. We are exempt of that. That is an incorrect, that's a fallacy. But because these are centuries in the making, you know, this is going to take an incredibly long time to undo the systematic aspects of it that exist in all of the institutions and organizations that are often advancing this work. Just the way that institutions are developed in the way that they do or do not, let's say, engage with communities would be a perfect example. But when you look at repair initiatives in any space, whether it's international or within the United States, it's a process. There's a site in Virginia where they passed reparative compensatory reparations for, and I kind of alluded this to before, for education that was denied during massive resistance, which was a period after Brown v. Board. And it was basically the majority of the Confederate states enacted this resistance to desegregating schools. Anyway, the state of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia, passed a reparations scholarship program. That was the first piece. Then over time, they began to do memorialization. Now we're seeing integration into curriculum, required education in the curriculum on this history, so it's not erased. Now we're seeing the compensation scholarship going to the next generation, because the impact was generational, because the literacy rates for that cohort of who were denied education was 75%. So you're beginning to see this, you know, justice is, I want to say, it's ongoing.
Yeah. It's iterative, right?
It's a process, and it's not a one and done. You can't enact a policy and say, we did it. It's great. We're over with. No, it's a process, and it's almost like an unpeeling of an onion, and there are layers. And as you peel back one layer, you see another. And hopefully, if we're committed, we'll continue to peel back those layers so that, as Justin was saying, we have a more just society that really does care for all members.
Yeah, yeah. I want to end our conversation back here in Detroit, where I know you guys are just kind of beginning, really, some of the work that you'll do with our reparations task force and our city council. And I want to get your early impressions of where we are, what we're doing here, and what it says, not just about us, but about this this issue nationally. One of the things that we talk about a lot here in Detroit is how symbolic Detroit and its history are to the struggles that we have nationally as Americans, particularly when you're talking about race and inequality. And I just wonder if you're at a point yet where you're seeing some of that play out or influence the dynamic in terms of what we're trying to do here. And of course, we're very early in it, and we don't even have a report yet about the history. But I know that you're working with our task force, and I'm curious about your reaction so far. Linda, I'll start with you this time.
Well, first of all, I just want to give a shout out to the members of the Reparations Task Force that have been assisting us in the process. They've been exceptional. And we have actually been connected to a significant number of organizations that are working specifically on repair initiatives in the communities. And that's a really important piece. So I want to say that you know, the fact that you have so many organizations that are very well founded in their efforts to address like criminal justice or to address education disparities or food insecurity is a real benefit, actually, because you already have a very strong core of community-led organizations that are already doing this work and know how to do it in their communities. Mm. And that will be an incredible asset to our research because we will learn from them what's worked in the communities and how they've been filling the gap for those services that the government has not provided. So that's an important piece to our process, and I think we're in good shape.
Wow. Yeah. Justin, what are you seeing here in Detroit?
You know, I mean, it's very early to tell with the City of Detroit's commission. And to be honest, the very few commissions around the country have been completed in terms of their work. So this is a really a new day for all of us. But, you know, one of the things that we're hoping to do is to come in, and we have something we call the Black Audit Project, where we try to take a snapshot of the state of the Black community in cities around the country, mm-hmm. using the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals as our measure. So the real questions we want to ask are, how is Detroit doing in terms of access to healthcare, access to education, access to clean water, access to housing, access to, you know, criminal justice equity? How is Black Detroit doing on these measures? And if we do see disparities, and I'm sure we will, mm-hmm. if we do see problems, how much of those problems are due to structural issues that go back generations that demand some sort of restorative redress and repair and reparation? Yeah. And that's what we're hoping to be able to document during our time in Detroit. We can only do that with the community's involvement. And if there are solutions that are going to come from this process, it's going to come from the City of Detroit.
It's going to come from us as Detroiters.
It's going to come from Detroiters themselves.
I believe that.
It's going to come from the grassroots. So if I could leave with one message, I would tell everyone to just keep hope alive and come out. And, you know, we're going to do everything we can to make change in the city, in cities around the country and around the world where our people are facing injustice. And this is the first step. We have to enter the conversation and be willing to engage. And we start here.
Yeah. We'll be right back with more Creative Equal.
So, Stephen, you also had the opportunity to sit down with a familiar friend, someone who's also been on Detroit Today as well, but really talk to the public, to the listeners, and to him about what's going on, particularly in Detroit, with reparations the task force and what all that looks like.
Yeah, I thought that was a really important way to end these discussions this week by bringing it back to Detroit specifically and talking about our history, how important that history is, and how it makes us kind of stand out, I think, among other cities in terms of how we go about assessing what reparations might be necessary and getting to the place where we're trying to do it, and how we deal with these issues as the largest majority African-American city in the country has resonance in a way in other cities and in the national conversation that I think is important. And so I thought Ken Coleman would be the perfect guest for that, and he really was. He's not just an historian, he's also an author and a journalist and somebody who really is thinking about these things from all of those different perspectives and is able to put it in that historical and national context. Ken, before we get to our listeners, I do want to have you talk about what we've done in the last year or so since the Reparations Task Force was convened and where you see things headed this year. Now, Keith Williams, who is the chair of the Reparations Task Force, joined me for an interview a few weeks ago to talk about what he's up to and what he's thinking and how he can get things moving. But I'm curious, as someone who's thought about this for such a long time, what do you think the approach should look like? What do you think the goal should be? And what are the outcomes we might expect?
Well, you know, it's a huge question. I mean, I think candidly, and I think that Keith Williams, as chair of the organization, would probably admit that they've had some growing pains, and they've had some people request
five vacancies.
People have left the task force. I think it's, I think that any governmental process has its machinations, right? It's like, you know, sausage making or preparing sausage. I do think they have struggled a little bit from an organizational standpoint, just trying to, you know, get things going, you know, acquiring a budget, trying to identify, you know, someone, an administrator to help, you know, help that process. You know, I had the pleasure of serving on the Detroit Charter Revision Commission.
Right. I remember that.
A dozen years ago or so. And, I see some of the challenges
that was a difficult process.
It's a difficult process, right? And you've got personalities, and so that has been the challenge as I see it looking from the outside.
I think that's a really interesting analogy, and it's not one that I've heard a lot of people or anyone make between the Reparations Task Force and the Charter Revision Commission, which
everybody's got a view of the world,
right?
And I that body, the Reparations Task Force, I think is 13 members or at least 13 positions, and you know they're appointed by members of the Detroit City Council. You know they had some resignations, but people forget with Joanne Watson's passing. That was a huge void in terms of, you know, sort of knowledge of the issue. I mean, Joanne, the late Joanne Watson, former city council member and was a member of the task force, was a member of the NCOBRA national, reparations, movement. You know, people forget John Conyers, the late John Conyers would introduce a reparations bill, every session since 1989. Joanne was a part of a lot of that, at times working on Congressman Conyers' staff. And so that was a loss to the group. I mean, there are a lot of great people who are members. I know many of them. But that was a setback, I think, for the group. And I think they're trying to get their footing.
Yeah. 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. Call and tell us what you make of Detroit's effort to sift through the morass of history of the history of discrimination here against African Americans and come up with solutions to make people whole who were damaged, to repair things that got broken. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag WDET, and we can work you into the conversation. We're going to start today with Daniel in Detroit. Daniel, welcome to Create It Equal.
I thank you for having me on again. The last time you guys were discussing this topic, I got to, you guys put me on the air, but I didn't get a chance to really convey my position.
Okay.
So I was really excited when I heard you were doing another show on this. So from my perspective, okay, what we have done to the black community is we have redlined them out of potential generational wealth by keeping them out of good neighborhoods. We have run our freeways through their homes and through their businesses, and we have underfunded their schools and not given them the opportunity for education. So from my perspective, throwing money at this problem and giving people large checks does not solve this long term. Mm. And that was my point last time I was on the air. Yeah. What would solve this long term is if we gave black people in Michigan, because we're talking about Michigan reparations, we gave them low interest mortgages or no interest mortgages, no down payments on mortgages. We gave them free schooling like we do Native American Indian people. We give them low interest loans for businesses, or maybe no interest loans for businesses. We go back and we incentivize them to go to school, to buy homes, to start businesses. And we look at this as like a 10 or 20 year project. Mm. We don't just give out blank checks. Yeah. We've
Daniel, first I want to commend you. I'm assuming something here that you're not a member of the African American community. I think that's a pretty safe assumption, but I can tell from your call that you're somebody who's actually sitting and thinking about this and leaning into the idea that it is a problem that needs to be solved. That is a huge hurdle still, I think, for an awful lot of Americans who either don't understand the connection between the things that we see today and the history of discrimination, or don't care. They just don't feel like that America ought to have to deal with these things, to confront them and fix them. So I want to first of all say you are part of the solution as far as I'm concerned in terms of how we think about this. I would also, though, start off in response to what you said by saying I don't think this has to be an either or, and I don't know that that's a helpful framework to start thinking about these things. I mean, you're saying it shouldn't be checks or money. It should be these systemic changes, things that would grow wealth in the black community. Both of those things, I think, can be done in tandem in response to the question of how do you repair what got broken. But I love your list of systemic changes, right? I live in Detroit. I've lived in Detroit most of my life. The neighborhood where I was born, near Grand River and Livernois, was split in half in 1973, so this is while I was alive, by the construction of I-96, the Jeffries Freeway. Both sides of the neighborhood have had the worst time in the last 50 years trying to recover from that. I mean, it absolutely devastates property values. It devastated the idea of community on both sides of the freeway. I mean, it is a defining moment in the neighborhood's decline. You can go up and down the block of the street that I was born on and talk to people who bought their homes in the 1960s and have seen nothing but decline in the values since then. So absolutely, you're on the right track, but the either-or thing, I can't get on board with that, but that's okay. I mean, I think there should be lots of ideas out there. Ken, I'll give you a chance to respond to Daniel as well.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. Thank you, Daniel, the caller. I mean, but I think this is what, you know, this is what I'm suggesting, you know, going to every neighborhood, every community, you know, making that list, hearing testimony, if you will, from people. My parents grew up along Grand River,
that's right,
as well, Grand River and Joy Road. I know that part of the Old West Side well, and you know, Grand River doesn't look nearly the way it did when we were, you know, when we were kids, and it was starting to decline. I think even then we're about the same age. But again, it's a question of, you know, what are our priorities as a community, mm-hmm, an African American community, which is a large part of the city of Detroit, and figuring out what should be city government's role in making Black folk whole, right?
And the things that Daniel's talking about here. Investing in education, making it more accessible to African Americans, making home ownership easier for African Americans who were absolutely locked out of ownership in many neighborhoods in Detroit.
Indeed.
Well into the 70s and 80s, making it possible or easier to start businesses, which is a huge wealth generator. I think all of I'm signing up for all of that stuff, right? As systemic change, because I think. The point where I agree the most with Daniel is that you want to do this in a way that changes things going forward, doesn't just fix what got broken, but gives people in the future better opportunities.
Right. I go back to the opportunity for school-aged children today and adults that might want to have a look at a second career. I mean, I love the opportunity to go to a college or university, tuition free. Other cities around the country have done that. I mean, the Kalamazoo
We have Detroit Promise.
And we have a Detroit Promise as well. Yeah. I mean, that it's something that I think that could be a tangible way to repair, I'm not opposed to cash infusions of cash. it has the work, right? Because it is, at least for this Detroit experience, it is a process that's going to go. City government is going to be part of, that process, and so it has to work itself out that way.
Yeah. I mean, the cash part of that is important, I think, from the perspective of Americanism. Mm-hmm. When we think of the way we fix things that we broke in this country, we think of money. We have an entire civil legal system that is convened around the idea of assessing that kind of damage and paying. And I think that's a critical part of what we're doing here, is saying that here people were wronged. There is a way to calculate the value.
How do you feel about your first highlights episode?
Well, I think it's an interesting way to try to wrap up all the work that goes into framing these programs. I mean, this first week is a great example of the kind of intentionality, I think, that we're trying to bring to Created Equal and the way in which we want to make connections between things that are going on here in Detroit and things that are going on nationally. And so it makes sense on the last day of the week,
right,
just kind of look back a little and say, how did we do with all of this? And what were the highlights of those shows? And so I'm really pleased with the show that wraps them up. But I'm also, of course, already thinking about next week and how we do that. And we've got a really great show.
Gotta let them know.
Coming up on Monday, we're going to talk with Ned Blackhawk, who is a history professor at Yale University and author of a book called Rediscovering America. It is about the relationship between Native peoples and the United States, which, of course, dates back hundreds of years, has been undertold and mistold so many times. Ned's work really tries to tell it in a truthful and contextual way that helps us understand the challenges that we still have that to make sure that Native peoples are not just respected but included and given the same opportunities as everybody else. So different subject,
same themes.
But really going ahead with this idea of Detroit as ground zero for these discussions in America.
Yeah, it sounds good.
That'll do it for this episode of Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes online at WDET.org and make sure you subscribe to our podcast. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Additional production support comes from Jack Philbrant. Audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Our program director is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.